listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm your host, Abby, and joining me is my new co-host, also named
Abby. We're librarians at the Central Library. Thanks for having me on the podcast, Abby. I'm excited to be a part of it.
Excited to have you as part of it. In this episode, we hear a recording of a virtual event focused on parenting with neuroscience through the lens of self-control.
But before we get to that, we've got book chat.
Okay, book chat. Abby, since this is your first time on the podcast, I think it's a good opportunity for us to get to know what it is that you like to read. And I know that you had some like kind of fun tidbits about your reading that you wanted to share. So do you want to start with one?
Absolutely. So one interesting thing about me, as far as books go, is my first literary obsession, shall we say, was historical fiction juvenile novels about the Holocaust. So the first time I read one of those books was fifth grade. It was called Stones and Water, and it was just a really interesting book. I had never read historical fiction before. So it was my first kind of entryway into historical fiction. And after that, for some reason, I was just hooked on all the stories about the Holocaust. Because they really inspired me, and also they were terrifying and sad and scary, and it was a lot to handle as a kid, but I think it was just like kind of my segue into just learning about the world and how really kind of it can be super terrible, but they were just great stories and ultimately neat to learn about and be inspired by. So how about you, Abby? What was maybe some of your first books that you really remember getting into and made you a big reader?
I love this question, and I loved that you posed the idea. When I was a young child, we never had pets, so I would just obsessively read the encyclopedia entries for dogs and cats. And then when I was like 10 or 11, I stumbled across All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot. So it's an odd choice for a child, but it's his memoir of being a country vet. And I was just captivated and would read and reread it and reread it. And that's the first book I remember really being like obsessively connected to. I had to keep rereading it. And then, of course, the one that I think people in our age range all share is Harry Potter. I was about his age when somebody put the first book in my hand. And then the books were released when, you know, as I continued growing up until I think the last one came out around the time I finished high school or started college. So it was very much growing up with Harry Potter. So I think those are probably the two most striking reading obsessions from being a kid.
I love that we both kind of started with these a little bit peculiar kind of books for kids.
Yeah.
But also I will say, so that all of our listeners know, I am probably one of the only people who does not like the Harry Potter books. So everyone can feel free to criticize me and make fun of me and also hate me for that. But
I think that's fair. I know there are a few holdouts, people who don't like enjoy them or never read them. Mm-hmm. If I probably would not have picked them up if the person who put it in my hand had not put it in my hand. So, I think it really depends on kind of what you were reading as a kid or what you were already interested in. So.
Yeah. And it's interesting. That's a good segue into another thing that I wanted to share with everyone, which was the last book that surprised me. So I like to read, you know, realistic fiction or character driven. I read a lot more historical fiction as a younger kid or young adult, as I already said, but these days I'm kind of into the realistic fiction, kind of family stories or large cast novels. So the last book that surprised me was actually a Western, because I'm not really into, you know, the fantasy sci-fi. That's why I couldn't get into Harry Potter. And I never thought that I would enjoy a Western. I just thought, I'm not sure about this. I never gave it a shot, but I had just assumed I didn't like it. But my husband read Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. And he said, such a good book. It was, he just begged me to read it. He said, this is the only book I'll ever ask you to read. So finally I caved and I read it. And it really surprised me because I loved it. And I think it was because even though it was a genre Western, the writing was just so compelling to me. I remember just laughing at the humor and the dialogue and in the characters. And so it just kind of goes to show that even if a book is outside of your genre, you might still like it. So that was interesting for me.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think that the book that surprised me the most recently was also one that's outside of my kind of preferred reading genre. I'm someone who likes to read like speculative fiction. So probably the exact opposite of what you like. Yeah. So like my interest, I think everyone defines speculative fiction a little bit differently. But the idea being, you know, things that span kind of sci-fi and fantasy, and there's not usually a lot of world building, or not a huge amount, not necessarily character driven, a lot more to do with plot. But they're kind of asking the question like, well, but what if this? Right? So like, if we keep doing this thing, what will happen? That sort of thing, which is fairly vague. And I don't usually read in the past too much at all. But the book that most surprised me recently, I read a few months ago, was Jacqueline Woodson's Red at the Bone. So she writes both in poetry and prose, and this is one of her very few adult novels in prose that are it's beautifully written. Really, I'm not sure why I was so surprised. I felt at the end that when I was surprised actually by kind of where the story went. And everyone I talked to who read it was also like, oh yeah, no, I was also surprised by that. And it's not like it's a mystery. It's just that it's set in a very particular time and place. And I think we're just far enough from that time. And if you weren't in that place, I think it would be hard to see it coming, which is the vaguest way I can describe it. But basically the time and place of it was something I wasn't considering as I was reading it until that became important. And it's just done so lovely, and she explores family and identity and relationships in the same way that she does in a lot of our work. This one really surprised me.
Yeah, I need to read that.
It's great. It's quick, as so many of her books are, and it does read very very smoothly, and yeah, I'm sure I have a copy somewhere I can lend you.
So what are you reading now? I know we're not doing a formal book talk, this book chat, but if you just want to give me a little glimpse of what you're reading now.
Yeah, so I have been taking a break from nonfiction for the past few months because I feel like the realities of the world are depressing enough, and what I tend to read in nonfiction also tends to be quite depressing. But I have been very drawn to stories that involve pandemics or epidemics, things like that, and kind of set in a variety of genres. I've just been kind of grabbing whatever I can. And then when that gets to be a little too real or a little overwhelming, I will kind of browse the YA section. And I'm very shallow when it comes to books. So when I see covers that I like, I'll like flip them open to see if it's like, okay, great, this storyline doesn't seem like a downer. And so I'll just grab a few of those. So I've got a wide variety of YA books on my shelf right now to be read when I need something to pick me up.
That's awesome. Yeah, I am the newest person on the reference team, as our listeners have just found out, but I come from youth services, and so I also really like to read YA. I'm not reading YA, but I'm mostly actually reading, whatever, audiobooks. I'm doing that on my way into work, and so my favorite way to enjoy audiobooks, I don't know if other people feel this way, but when I read an audiobook, I like to listen to an old favorite, because then if I miss a little bit or I get a little distracted, if I'm doing something else, it's okay, but I still get to kind of relive the story. So I would encourage, if anyone is not yet gotten into audiobooks, I would say try reading a book on audiobook that you already know you love, because it's fun to just hear it too, as opposed to you remember reading it and now you get to listen to someone else read it to you, and that's very fun. So I'm reading The Bean Trees right now on audiobook, and it's great.
That's excellent. I love that idea. If you are a rereader, this is an incredible way to reread. If you aren't, this might make you one. So I think that's great. Next, we'll hear a recording of a virtual program held this summer. This program, Parenting with Neuroscience, Self-Control, was the final event of a 4-session series offered by Dr. Erin Claybaugh. We'll link to previous episodes with recordings of her events in our show notes. Each of these events is also available as a video recording, so we'll link to those as well.
So hi, everyone. I'm Haley Tompkins. I'm the branch manager of the Crozet Library, and we're here today to learn about self-control, and this is our last in our series about parenting with neuroscience with Dr. Erin Claybaugh. Dr. Erin Claybaugh is a neuroscientist. She's a professor and a mother of 4 and the author of Second Nature, How Parents Can Use Neuroscience to Help Kids Develop Empathy, Creativity, and Self-Control, which you can buy where books are sold or check out from the library in print or in ebook format. This webinar will also be recorded, and you can watch this and others in this series on the JMRL YouTube when this is all finished. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Erin, and we're excited to learn more about self-control today.
Thank you. Will I be able to share?
You should.
Yeah. PowerPoint?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. All right, here we go. So self-control. This is one of the things that parents spend so much time on, so much time. And I too, as a parent, have spent maybe more time with some children than others on this, because it does seem to be something that some kids have more of than others. And so I think when I first started parenting, I felt like some kids were born with self-control and some kids were not. I know that schools, especially elementary schools and preschools, spend an inordinate amount of time trying to teach kids to have more self-control. So this was one of the things that I knew as a parent that probably was changeable in some way and that I should be working on it. But what I found when I started looking in the literature is the way to go about it was different than I had thought initially. And so I'm a basic neuroscientist. My training is in the brain and molecular genetics and in, you know, doing neurons in a dish and seeing how they can connect together and how we can influence that with toxins and things that make it less functional, and how maybe we can actually help it become more functional. And this is kind of why I ended up writing this book, is this intersection of parenting, what I was doing at home, and then what I was doing in the lab. And I was trying to keep them separate for years. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me that they merged so well. And so this book is kind of the result of the merging of those two kind of things that I had been keeping separate. So in the book, this is what it looks like. It has peer-reviewed research throughout the whole thing. So I don't say anything in here that there's not a scientific article to back it up. And this is part of just my training as a scientist, I think, that I need to be able to provide support for every claim that I make. But the thing that's interesting about this book in terms of this merging for me is when I first started parenting, was spending a lot of time teaching skills that I thought were important. And when my children started to grow and become individual people more, I realized that these three things on this PowerPoint, empathy, self-control, and creativity, were the things where I felt like it was the most important to concentrate my parenting effort. And it's for two reasons. The first is that when I looked in the literature, it showed consistently that these three things were really important for making happy, autonomous adults. That happy, autonomous adults had these three qualities. And then the second thing is that I felt like in the regular education that my kids were getting outside the home, they weren't really getting trained in any of these three things. So this is why I chose these three particular things. I also was surprised somewhat to figure out that self-control can be taught, but also empathy and creativity can also be taught. So if you're interested in empathy or creativity, those were what the two previous sessions that we did were about, why they're important and how you can cultivate them in kids. So I started thinking about all these different things that are linked to these three specific skill sets. And I started seeing how these skill sets were actually linked together as well. So self-control, if you look at all these words that we're trying to get our kids to really embody, and these are all traits that we want to work on all the time with our kids, self-control is a component of many, many of these. So we are looking for some kind of a roadmap. We're trying to give our kids a roadmap. We want to do our very best by them. We're motivated by love. And so with that, we realized that we have to be able to get our child to not be in the way of himself or herself. Like, this is what self-control is all about. You want to have goals that you want to realize at some point, and you have to make sure that you don't get in the way of you, if that makes sense. So I want to talk about this thing called phenotypic plasticity. So phenotypic plasticity is the scientific word for phenotype, what you look like or what you act like, being plastic or able to be changed. So these two things come together here: your genes, so the DNA that you were born with, and your phenotype, so this is how you look and act. Now, everybody here knows that genes have some influence over what we look like and what we act like, okay? But there's also another really important component here, and this is that of environment. So this is the traditional nature-nurture debate. As I learned more about this nature-nurture debate, I realized that there is no debate at all. It is actually genotype and phenotype and environment all kind of coming together to give us what we know, you know, as what a person is or acts or does or even looks like. So the idea then of this phenotypic plasticity is the ability to be able to change the way we act or the way we look in response to changes in the environment. Sometimes this happens without us even being aware of it. Sometimes this is something that we can actively try to do and kind of change ourselves. So we're given these set genes, and then the environment through development has a really powerful way of turning genes on and off. Okay, so you can actually increase the amount of some gene expressions and decrease the amount that other genes are expressed. That has nothing to do with us really in terms of just development. This is a natural process. This is why your hair cells look different than your toe cells, look different than your iris cells. So they're always being turned on and off. The environment though can also have some effects. So what we're exposed to, what one neuron actually has done or not done in the past, it impacts the way that they're going to behave in the future. So this idea of environment is equally important to this genotype in terms of what the phenotype looks like. Okay, so let's talk about this in the context of self-control. So we know that self-control is important. This was one of the first studies that I found when I just typed into the literature, you know, important predictor of adult happiness or adult success. And so self-control is dependent on, so they do, let's talk about the marshmallow study. I guess we'll start there. So there was this marshmallow study back in 1970 that I'm sure most people have heard about, where they basically take a child who's about 4 years old and they're in the lab and they tell them, hey, there's a marshmallow right here. If you cannot eat it for a certain amount of time, then you can have two marshmallows at the end of that time. And then the researcher will basically leave the child there with the marshmallow and they'll leave the room. Okay. And so what the child does here is either they can wait, right? And so then at the end of the time, which is about 10 minutes, they'll get the two marshmallows, or they cannot wait. And if they cannot wait, then they'll go ahead and eat the marshmallow. Okay. And so what happened after this study is kind of interesting, is it became the symbol for self-control. So there were delayers that were able to wait and get two marshmallows, and there were non-delayers, which couldn't wait and just ate the marshmallow. So this was one of the first studies that really showed us, hey, self-control, we're going to define it as the ability to wait for 10 minutes for a treat. Okay, so you can see this is kind of problematic. I don't know if everybody would define self-control in this way, but this study got a lot of traction. And people have looked over time at these original kids who, when they were 4 years old, they were allowed to either wait for the marshmallow or they decided not to wait for the marshmallow in this test. So they tested them again when they were in their 40s. And what they found is that they looked at them again. So 1,000 people, and they found higher health rates that were good health, wealthier, lower crime rates, meaning like, have you ever been incarcerated kinds of things. But these things all went up, and they went up in the kids that they were higher in the delayers, the ones that could wait. Okay. They also found a different study that people who could delay and wait actually had higher SAT scores as adolescents. And when they retested these kids when they were 40 years old, using a test that wasn't exactly like the marshmallow test, because we have to think about what a person values, right? So a 4-year-old might value a marshmallow more than a 40-year-old. So they did a different version of this to see if they could kind of delay reactions or not. And they found that it was pretty stable in terms of a self-control measure. So if this is stable from the time you're 4 to kind of displaying the same behaviors when you're 40, that's really important, I think, for parenting, for us to understand that self-control, as defined by the ability to wait for a marshmallow, seems to be about the same between 4 and 40 years old. And for me, when I first heard this, I started to get really concerned, because that means what? That you have to do all of the work that you're going to do as a person on your own self-control by 4 years old, by preschool. And then that determines your basically like your life outcome. But I figured there has to be more to this. And here's just a citation in terms of if you're interested in looking up this paper. And the citation for the original study is down at the bottom. So when we're thinking about this, it becomes really important how we measure self-control. Here's two versions of what will happen if you say, you know what, I think I might have issues with self-control. Or you think, you know what, wonder if my child actually has issues with self-control. Most parents will know, right? Because it's one of the things you're always working on. But if you don't know, here's two ways to kind of think about it. So this first one on the left is the questionnaire. And this questionnaire is something that the person themselves takes. So the person who you're trying to see if they have self-control or not, they would take it. And they would basically just answer from 1 to 5 on a Likert scale, whether these things are true about them or if they're false. So I do things without giving them enough thought. I become wild and crazy and do things other people might not like. So there's 5 statements here. So you can answer this for your child, and you can have your child, if they're old enough to be able to do this, to also answer. You can compare your scores. So typically, and also realize that the last one is reverse coded. So this is just to make sure that you're not just saying 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. So the average score here, now you can see for more than 15,000 people from 12 to 28 years old was 2.48. And the higher you go here, it's the less self-control you have. Okay. And so when you give yourself this measurement, if you're a lot higher than 2.5, basically, then that might indicate that you do have low self-control. It's also interesting to see if your score and your child's self-perception of this match up. So if self-control is an issue, do they know that it's an issue or not? Are they aware of it? So for this other test on the right, this is an example of what's called the go, no-go test. And it literally is they'll put you in front of a computer and they'll try to see, can you inhibit your own impulses? So they might give you smiley faces. And every time you see a frowny face, you're supposed to hit a different button. Okay. Or they might then change the rules on you. So you might do that for a minute. And then after a minute, they'll say, now I want you to not hit every time you were supposed to hit before, right? For the smiley face. So this is a way to see, can you regulate what you're doing? And are you able to pivot? And that pivot, that flexibility is really important to be able to have good self-control. So not just self-report, but there are actually tests that can see, do you have problems with inhibition and controlling your own behavior? Like what you want to do, are you actually able to do what you want to do? Okay, so when we do ask our kids to wait, like in this marshmallow test, or when we're giving them instructions, what is interesting about our society right now is that in the last 50 years or so, the ability to wait. So this would be one more measure of self-control. It's really dramatically decreased. It's dropped. And so one example of this is they did a study in the 1940s where they just looked at, can kids stand still? So in the 1940s, three-year-olds pretty much couldn't stand still when the researchers asked them. Five-year-olds were able to stand still for about 3 minutes, and seven-year-olds can do it for pretty much as long as the researchers ask them to do it. But now, when they redid this study 50, 60 years later, what they found is everybody shifted down. So now the five-year-olds can't stand still, and the seven-year-olds can stand still for about 3 minutes, which is where the five-year-olds used to be. And so we're really having a deficit here just in terms of being able to wait and do nothing when someone tells us to. Now, is this self-control? Maybe. It certainly is worth taking note of. It's also interesting that in our society, it's decreased, and it's decreased in a rapid fashion, so rapid that it cannot be due only to mutations in genes, and that the genes for being able to wait are now not in our society. It's too quick. That can't happen in just one or two generations. So there's something going on here that's environmental. And this is more evidence here that there is something environmental going on with self-control. And that is that there are cultural differences now in who passes, meaning they can wait for the second marshmallow test. So about 40% of American kids nowadays are able to wait for the second marshmallow. But 30% of German kids can wait. So that's lower in the German children who were tested. And in children who live in Cameroon, they actually were way higher than American kids. So 70% of Cameroonian kids were able to wait and delay. And this is likely due to just what the children are exposed to. So different parenting. So in Cameroon, kids are more used to waiting, and they help on their family's farm, and they may often be the primary caretakers for their little siblings. And so this is further evidence that shows that what we do and what we're asking our kids to do or not do in our society these days is making a difference in terms of the amount of self-control that our kids appear to have. So I have three things that I want to tell you about self-control. First is that it's teachable, which I think most of us know this. And I just provided some evidence showing that based on what is in the environment, that is one of the ways that we can teach it. So it's teachable through practicing, through doing it. The second thing that I want to tell you about self-control is self-control, by definition, is always a state of inaction. Okay, so we may think about self-control in a similar way that we think about willpower. Can we resist? Can we know? Can we say a no to ourselves for something that we really kind of want to do anyway? And the third thing that I want to tell you is that self-control is a resource that can be used up. So there's so many studies out there that basically will give somebody something to do that's hard and tedious, and it takes concentration and it takes control, and they will put them in this situation where they have to do something that's onerous, like putting little needles from one thing to another without getting pricked. Or they will put them in a situation where they tell them to not think about a white bear. And then they leave them alone for 5 minutes and say, no matter what you do, don't think about a white bear. So these are things that are difficult to do, and they involve saying no to yourself. And what they find is that then when they ask them to do a different task, the people who have been using self-control to not do something do worse on these tasks. Okay, so there's a limited amount. It's a resource that can be used up. So knowing what we know then about self-control, about these three things, I want to talk to you about the types of experiences that our kids have. So we want to be putting self-control experiences in front of our children, because not only is it a resource that can be used up, but self-control is also like a muscle where it stinks to use it as you're using it, because it's hard and it takes work. But over time, your muscle will get stronger. Initially, it'll stink and it'll be sore and you'll be exhausted. But the next time you do it, you'll have built up that muscle. So self-control is the same way, where practicing self-control actually makes us be able to say no to ourselves and to things around us that we shouldn't do more easily. So experience then instead of just thinking of experiences and something that our children should or should not go through, we really need to think about experience as a drug that shapes the brain, because it can change things in very real and permanent ways inside our neurons, inside our nuclei of our neurons, inside the DNA, inside the nucleus. So what I'm showing you here is some pictures of DNA. So DNA, everybody knows, has this double helix shape. But this double helix shape then actually gets kind of packaged into a really small space so that it can go inside the actual nuclei and doesn't take up a ton of room. And what happens is it's got these little spools that it winds around to kind of, like a spool and thread, the DNA would be the thread, and it winds around it to keep it compact so that it's easier to handle. All right. So you can have these spools be kind of packed together really tightly, and the genes are all like tight in there together, and they can't be used very well. All right. So to use a gene, you have to have the DNA be elongated. You have to have a protein come in, and it has to be able to read the code. And then the cell has to be able to do what the code says. So it makes certain proteins that then go do certain jobs in the cell. If you have DNA that's all tightly packed together and it can't be read, it's going to be turned off. All those genes that are on there are not going to be being used. Sometimes this is good because you don't want to turn on a blue gene for like pigment for eye color in your like stomach, right? There's no need for that. So that blue gene for your eye color will stay off in a stomach cell. Okay. Same thing here. We don't need all our genes. We don't want all our genes. And we want to be able to turn them on and off as needed. And this is where this idea of epigenetics comes in. So epigenetics is this field that is relatively new the last couple of decades, of the interaction between environment and genes, and how what happens in the environment can put these little tags that are shown here as the green and as the red in the top and in the bottom onto the DNA. And it can make it so that the DNA gets real tightly clustered together and you can't use it, or it'll make it so that it relaxes. And when it relaxes, then the genes that are hidden in there can be used and protein can be made of it. Okay, so experience can actually do this. It can put these little tags on the genes to make them cluster up and not be used, or it can release the tags and then have the genes turn on. That is like such a cool thing because it can be mediated by practice. So when you practice something, you can actually make genes be turned on in the nucleus. And then those genes will make proteins that go and support the exact neuron connections that you're making with the practice so that they get stronger, which is amazing if you think about it, that your role as parents actually can turn on and off genes in your children by the experiences that you ask them to go through. It's amazing to me. All right, so how do we then get our kids doing the kind of practice that we feel like will help them get these skills, so self-control, and then, as we'll talk about in a couple minutes, by default, to boost self-control, you also need to boost creativity and self-control, or sorry, and empathy in order to have all of those choices available to your child. So there are three steps that really will help work towards the ownership of life, of your own actions, your own choice, and your own self. So the first is to give power back to the child so that they feel like they're actually in charge of their own life. The second is this idea of scaffolding experience. So how do you place these experiences in the path of your child in a way that the things that you feel like they need to work on, you're working on with them? And importantly, the things that you don't want to work on, you don't let them practice, because practice will make whatever skill it is better. Okay. So then you have to make space for them to be able to practice independently. And it's possible that you're going to need to get in there and do some more scaffolding so that they understand kind of the right direction to go in. So this idea that practice is important, but it has to be the right kind of practice is really important. So I'm going to touch back on this picture of what happens at the intersection between two neurons. So when one neuron talks to another neuron, there's a space in between them. And in that space, that's the synapse. In the synapse, you've got neurotransmitters. The neurotransmitters are going to take a signal from the first neuron and send it to the second neuron. And that synapse is amazing because there are so many ways that we can boost signals, make signals be diminished, modulate what happens on the first neuron, modulate what happens on the second neuron. In the second neuron, there's dozens of things that can happen to that next neuron in terms of if ions flow in, if other proteins are sent off to then go into the nucleus and change the genes that are being made in response to what came in at that synapse. There's tons and tons of things that can happen. It's really, really a plastic place. When a synapse is used, that synapse gets stronger. And when that gets stronger, then you have what ends up being a pathway. So when one neuron gets used and gives a message to the next neuron and the next neuron, as you continue to use this pathway through like a practice effect, this one pathway will get stronger. And remember, it's many pathways that we're talking about in our brains, lots and lots of pathways. And so this shows one neuron activating three neurons, and then you have three separate pathways going. But what we as parents really want to do is figure out selectively which of these pathways we want to strengthen and which ones we don't. And we do this by these experiences that our kids go through. So when we're talking about practice, what we're really talking about is forming habits. Okay, and so a habit is something that we generally define as an action that used to be something that we had to actively work to initiate. It was work to start, but now it's automatic. Okay, so that's typically the working definition that we have. We don't even think about it. It's a habit. It's no work to start it. It's our natural way of approaching a situation. All right, so neuroscience takes this definition and it makes it more biological, more concrete. So this is true that this action used to be actively initiated. Neuroscience tells us how that actually works. So a habit is a stable predisposition to act in a certain way, all based in these neuronal circuits. So it has got three parts to it. The first part says if you do something like a habit, habitual activity again and again, that the connection between the neurons in that pathway they're gonna get stronger. It will actually turn on genes that will then send proteins to that synapse and it will build it up. It'll make more receptors there on the receiving side. It'll make more connection points, okay? The second thing is that the behavior, whatever the habit is gonna get easier for you as a person because now you've built up these synapses, you're supporting them more, and now more information can just flow through that circuit. When that happens, that behavior gets easier for you. The third thing that makes a habit on a neuroscience level is that once you build up the synapses, and then once you have more info flowing through the circuit, that ease of flow means that that circuit is more likely to be used the same way in the future because it's easier. It takes up less resources for you. So that on a cellular level is what's happening when we form a habit. Now there's two different forms of habits that we can form. So routine habits are the habit that we think of as kind of the routine way that we do things. It's really inflexible. It's what we click into in terms of doing the same thing the same way every time. There's another kind of habit, and this one in green is the one that we want our kids to have. We don't really want our kids to have routine habits. This is always just clicking in like a robot, knowing how you're supposed to behave in a certain situation and just doing it. We want our kids to have learning habits. Learning habits increase our own cognitive control over our own actions. So this is the ability to kind of pause and think creatively, think empathetically, think in a goal-oriented way, in a really flexible, dynamic way about what you're gonna do in a specific situation. And what we want our kids to do is click into this flexible way of thinking when they're confronted with a problem, one that needs self-control or one that you need to have empathy or that you need to just kind of creatively come up with a solution that reaches your goal and doesn't interfere with the rights and feelings of others. So learning habits are really important thing to keep in mind, especially in a really reward-based society for self-control. So I went into the literature and I looked up how do you teach your kids self-control. So these are what I found in the studies. So the first thing that's really important is to model it. It is really impossible to tell our kids to have self-control when they are actively watching us not have self-control, when they're watching us put them in a timeout, but not putting ourselves in the timeout when we're angry, when we're telling them to go and do any of the things I'm about to talk about, and we're not willing to do it ourselves. That is going to be really problematic to teach your kids self-control in a way that they internalize it rather than just click into a habit of having to do it. So that means as parents, we need to be vulnerable. We need to be able to put ourselves out there and say, you know what? I need to work on these things too. Feed them. So I said self-control is a resource. You can use it up. That is evidenced by studies that actually show that if you give people a glucose-containing drink, and glucose is the fuel for neurons, that the glucose getting kids actually did better on self-control tasks, right? Because they aren't as depleted. And this is in comparison to giving kids a sugary drink, or people a sugary drink that did not have glucose, but instead had a different kind of sugar. They did not have as good self-control afterwards. Okay, number three, change their self-control attitude. This is really important that kids know that self-control is a teachable skill, and how they work on it is by practicing it. That is a muscle that can get stronger, similar to a muscle. And if they understand this, this is really enabling for your kids, because it's quite likely that kids with self-control problems have gotten the message at some point that they just are an issue. They have impulsivity issues, that they kind of are the one that gets sent to the little desk in the corner of the classroom to be by themselves because they can't control themselves. So being able to kind of help them through this next one too, positive self-talk, is really important to be able to have your kids say, I can do this. These are the tools that I have to do them. This is what I'm going to do. Even in difficult situations for younger kids, having them talk themselves through what they need to do. I will not touch the whatever it is. And there's been studies that show that prayer actually works. So prayer, more than just free thinking or free meditating or loving compassion exercises, actually worked better in order to have self-control on tests of self-control afterwards, which I found was really interesting that this is in the literature. Okay, emotional outlets. So people who are able to talk about their feelings, they do better on self-control tasks. Having concrete reminders. If you are having a situation where you want two kids to talk something out and somebody's supposed to be the listener and somebody's supposed to be the speaker, you can actually have little things that the kids hold. So the speaker can hold the mouth, a piece of paper, and the listener can hold the ears. And so this is a reminder of what they're supposed to be doing. And when it's time to switch the pieces of paper. Allow self-monitoring. This is really important in terms of accountability for your own behavior. They did a study where they asked people to basically take cards and sort the cards into their own basket or a different person's basket. And at the end of this task, they asked them about the cards. And the people that sorted the cards remembered the cards that went into their own basket more. So this idea of ownership is really important in terms of these skills. So allow somebody to monitor themselves. How are they doing? What's their progress look like? Allow co-monitoring. So to put two people in a task and allow one person to keep the other person on task. These things are really important for allowing self-regulation in the long term, but also reminding themselves to stay on task because they're going to be accountable for what they do. Okay, and then teach creativity and empathy. So in terms of seizing creativity and empathy, if you're able to creatively sit there and pretend that you are a soldier waiting for on guard duty and you're guarding the prisoners, those kids can stand still for way longer than the kids that were not taught that trick. So teaching your kids kind of these tricks when they're in a situation when they have to wait and be patient are important. You have to give them a reason to be able to do it. The same thing with empathy. So they might not be able to sit there and not take the last piece of cake for themselves, but they might be able to do it because they realize that if they do it, that Jenny won't get one. All right. So sometimes kids cannot do it for themselves, but they can do it if you distract them enough that they can have an inner, vivid, imaginative world, or they can do it for somebody else sometimes. Okay, so fostering this self-control then, the best way to really be able to have a kid that looks outwardly like they have great self-control is to actually work on self-regulation. Self-regulation is different than self-control. So self-regulation here is shown, you know, in a more real life kind of way. This is more problem solving. This is what you're going to get in social situations. This is the water fight that is lots of stuff going on. It's not just, am I going to eat one marshmallow, yes or no? So this means that where self-control is going to be like a red light all the time, self-regulation is going to be like a green light. So it's going to be not just no's in there, but you're also going to have the ability to say yes to certain things. And this is the most important thing that we can do for our kids. Allow them to be able to hear a no and do a no. That's self-control. But also allow them to have a goal that they can work through, to not always let it be a no. And by doing this, you can tap into the empathy and the creativity. And all three of these skills come together in this one like master skill of self-regulation, which is really what we need to have kids that grow up to be independent, perseverant, creative, like problem-solving, easy to be around kids that you want to take to lunch one day, you know, when they're grown up and sit down and have a really, they're interesting people that you like being around. So we think about kids that do this, that get around a no, sometimes in a little bit of an evil, mischievous way. So if you know a kid who gets a no, gets a stop, and then they do a workaround, we might think of them as a little bit manipulative or self-serving, right? This actually is a skill that we can foster. We just need to funnel it appropriately so that these skills are being used for good and not for evil. So we need to really think, how can we let our kids be a yes? How can, when they're in a situation that requires self-control, how can the no be turned into a yes? This example of being creative and pretending like you're in a situation where you're a guard having to be guarding the prisoners on the playground is an example of turning a no into a yes, okay? You've allowed yourself to be able to do the thing that outwardly still looks like self-control is a no, but really you're allowing yourself an avenue to get there that feels good to you. So self-regulation is also a teachable skill, and I'm going to talk about the ways that we can do this. So self-regulation has kind of a cycle here that we can use to scaffold the self-control and the self-regulation. So anything that we do, decisions that we make, have these processes in them, unless we skip over them, which we don't want to do. So first is you plan, then you take action, and then you have self-reflection. And then the whole thing happens all over again. So we tend in our society to blow right through this self-reflection. We plan and act and plan and act and plan and act. For us as parents, it's really important to slow the kids down. So make this self-regulation, this self-reflection part of this so that they learn from these decisions. So that when they do act and make the decisions, they're able to have this pause, able to be able to pivot if they need to, able to be able to like re-choose differently the second time if they should. All right, so this allows for a lot of mature play here in terms to like you want to be able to put them in situations where they can use the skills that you're trying to give them. Kids are never going to be able to self-regulate if they're always being told what to do, if they're always in school, sitting in the desk, having the teacher tell them what to do, if they are at lunch in their assigned seats and they have to act in a certain way, if after school they're going to violin lessons and then they're going straight to soccer and then they come home and they eat dinner and then they do their homework, they play an hour of video games and then they go to bed. They're never able to kind of get in there and make their own decisions. And if they do make decisions, it's really, you can choose to behave or you can choose not to behave and suffer the consequences. So we really need to try to put more opportunities for dynamic choices that actually are meaningful into our kids' lives. mature play is one of the best ways to do this. You have to be able to have this conflict scaffolding in there so that if something does happen, they know how to handle it. They know how, okay, I can kind of click into this if I made a bad decision, and this is how I can think about doing it differently next time. So this idea of mindfulness and reflection, there are five things here that I've put here. When you ask your child, let's say you have a timeout for your kid. Let's say there was conflict during mature play. What I would say about timeouts is we really need to use them differently. So if you put your child in a timeout, and I think the general rule of thumb right now is 1 minute for every year that they are old. But I tell you, by the time that you're 10 and you're in timeout for 10 minutes, that is a long time to be in timeout. It might give you, as a parent, a chance to cool off, which is not bad, but you really want to make sure that you're using these timeouts in a meaningful way. And so the way that I typically use timeouts is they're not necessarily minute-based. So I'll say, hey, you need to take some time apart from the situation. You can stay in your room or wherever you go as long as you need to. Make it be at least X amount of minutes, 5 minutes, and then don't come out until you're ready to kind of re-engage and to fix the issue so that we can move forward. But if you just put a kid in timeout and then when they come out, just force them to say they're sorry, sorry doesn't do anything in terms of changing that behavior the next time. It just makes them avoidant of getting caught, which is really not the kind of thing that we want to be teaching our kids. We want them to be able to adapt and be flexible to change the way they act in the situation to avoid hurting someone's feelings and to also get what they want at the same time. So for this mindfulness and reflection, I try to teach that you want to have a calm body. So if you're feeling angry and you're feeling upset and you need a cool off, that comes first. After your body's calm, then you can work on having a calm mind. So you can kind of have calmed down your body, your heart's not racing anymore, but you may still be super pissed. Right? And so you need to kind of wait until your mind is calm. Then you need to be able to check in with yourself and see how you feel. And naming the feelings here are important, naming these emotions and listening to your body. So you might have a calm body, but it might not actually be devoid of emotion. That's not the same thing as a calm body. You can still have like body signals that you need to listen to them. Then the fourth thing is an acknowledgement of the facts. What actually happened, all right, to make that conflict? And what was your role in it? You know, how did you participate in that conflict? And then the last one is critical reflection and prediction. So what ended up happening? And if the same thing, you know, happens next time, what will that look like? Prediction when you enter the situation, so-and-so is going to have really hurt feelings. You know, how is this going to go down when I finally come downstairs? What am I going to need to talk about? So this mindfulness training is really important. And if you put this in school settings, it's really transformative. It's helpful to see kind of what a school can do, because I think if a school can do it, we can certainly do it at home. So mindfulness here taps into these three really important ingredients of self-control. The first is what we're paying attention to. So if we don't even notice it, then we're not going to be able to control our own behavior. The second is how we regulate the emotions that we feel, right? And this is something that is a learning curve for kids. So little tiny children are not able to regulate their own behavior. They need to practice it, and they need to see you doing it, and they need to see you modeling in it, and they need to help you regulate their own behavior and their own emotions so that they can see what that's like, all right? And then the third thing is self-awareness. So this is putting together one and two. What are we paying attention to? And how are we regulating our own emotions? Those come together into self-awareness. So in terms of the classroom, there was a study that showed that 6 months of between 10 and 30 minutes of daily meditation / mindfulness.
Sorry, everyone. I think Erin might have just had a problem with her feed. We're going to hold on a minute.
Okay, so these last two that I put on there are understanding your child's value system. So this is where fostering the empathy and fostering the creativity really come into play. So tapping into empathy, this is where your child might be in situations where they have impulsivity, right? That they have to deal with. They have a goal, they have a want. And being able to not do that thing because they know how it's going to affect somebody else, this is where it's really important to build that empathy skill. Teach them cognitive empathy, being able to put themselves in someone else's shoes. Teach them what emotional empathy looks like. How do you recognize if somebody's feeling sad or if somebody's upset? How do you predict what's going to happen if you yank the teddy bear away from somebody else? What is the outcome likely going to be? So it's really important that we build empathy skills to be able to foster better self-control. So this is a scaffold taken from the empathy work in the book. And it basically shows you that when you have a situation where you put somebody in timeout, this is an example of what you can require from them before they kind of re-enter and go about their day. So the first one would be having ownership or accountability about their role in what happened, what the conflict was. The second is understanding how what they did affected people. So this is working on empathy as a skill. So it's practicing, but also it's allowing for reflection because they have to think about how you were affected. And then this last one taps into creativity. So how are you going to do it differently next time? We said that the pathways that you use the most in practice are going to be the ones that are more easy to click into, easier to use because of that flow of information. It is the same thing with thinking through the way you would act in a situation in the future. So let's say you have a fire in your house and your parents have gone through a fire drill plan with you and you know which exit you're supposed to go to and you have done a practice run in your head. You know where you're supposed to go. All right, you're going to get there quicker than if you've got no plan. All right, so this is the same thing here, where if you ask your children to specifically say, when I'm in that situation next time, how will I act? What would a different idea be? This is creativity. They're going to have to come up with some ideas. They could come up with 5 ideas and you guys can pick one together. And then they should own it. Yes, I will do that next time. And this will go a long way towards self-control and self-regulation. All right, so in terms of discipline, we got to talk about discipline if we're talking about self-control. Kids need to do 2 things with self-regulation. They need to be able to understand and know a no. They need to understand and know KN, what a no feels like and sounds like, okay? And this is part of discipline. So here are some things that help with allowing your kids to feel what a no feels like. First is make them wait, okay? So don't always kind of just jump in and do things for them. Don't always drop everything you're doing and attend to their needs. Like part of this is sometimes you wait, sometimes I wait. Don't always let them win. So if you're playing basketball with them, don't play really poorly on purpose every time. Part of life is not being successful every time you do something. And a 3-year-old shouldn't expect to win every time they play a 40-year-old person. It just doesn't, it's not accurate way of the way that life is. Sometimes, sure, because that helps with the power dynamic and that boosts them up, but not always. Don't always fix it for them. If they're having a tantrum because they can't put their shoes on and they want you to tie their shoes and you know that they can tie their shoes and do it well, don't always come in and tie their shoes, even if it's annoying and you might have to be late. And then teach affirmative consent. I think this is really important to let kids know that unless they hear an explicit yes, assume the answer is no. All right. This affirmative consent, we talk about a lot with like sexual stuff with teenagers and consent in terms of like dating and sexual activity. But I think it's really important for us to start teaching affirmative consent as young as our kids are, like in preschool. So if they didn't say yes, you can have it. If they didn't say yes, I like being squirted in the face with your water gun, then the answer is no. Unless they say yes, assume a no. And I think that's really important as our kids need to get used to working around a no. So this doesn't always mean that a no is a hard stop. Sometimes it just means that they cannot do it in that way. Okay. So this is where creativity comes in. So when you foster creativity, you are allowing your kids to say, okay, that's a no. I hear a no. How else can this get done? I have a goal. I really want to have a water gun fight with my brother. He is not letting me spray him in the face, right? How can I get this done? How can I still have this fun water gun fight? All right, so creativity is important here. Teaching kids, yes. This is something I think that we also need to think about. Sometimes our kids have to do stuff that our kids don't want to do. And so they're not hearing a no, they're hearing, well, you have to anyway. And this can be difficult for parents. And I think the place that this manifests for most parents is homework. So there are certain times when you actually just have to do things like homework. And in this situation, I would say allowing your kids to be as participatory as possible in the way that homework gets done is important. Okay, so allowing them to feel as much control as possible over when and where and in what way and what happens in terms of a motivating factor, I think that's important. Teaching them to share the load. So this would be chores around the house, not, you know, serving them all the time, but expecting them to pitch in, having these expectations in the household. And then the last one here is show them what service feels like. So volunteering and seeing that actually doing things for other people is so intensely rewarding. And kids don't naturally pick this sometimes. So showing them what it feels like by giving good gifts, by volunteering somewhere, by doing these yeses of action is really helpful in terms of having them understand that that's a choice. And it's not a forced choice. It's a choice that would make you feel good when you do it. So we're asking our kids to make these decisions. When we allow them to make the decisions, they get better at making the decisions. And when we practice making those decisions, this is like this fire drill. We kind of think ahead to the way we'll do it better next time. And it allows us to essentially have ownership of our lives. I don't know if you've ever tried to fix something for somebody, but when you fix something for somebody else and it doesn't turn out the way that you wanted or they wanted, guess who gets the blame for that? You do, because your fix wasn't the right fix. Like, we need to step back and allow our kids to do their own fixes and give them some support. But we need to be uninvested on a certain level in the outcomes of what our kids' decisions are. So the older they get, the less invested we need to become in terms of what choice they make and what the consequence is for them. You know, when they're little, we need to be more invested. But this idea of gradually stepping back is hard for parents because we get used to doing it in a certain way. We get used to being involved. It feels good to be involved. And so, you know, we need to make sure that we are stepping back when we need to as our kids grow up. And with this, understanding motivation is really important. So the things that motivate us as adults over kind of on the left are not the things that motivate kids in terms of what they're willing to work for. And so Peeps, great example of what might motivate kids. It might be as simple as goldfish, right? Their needs and their values are really different than ours. And so understanding where they're coming from is extremely important. This is another reason why the marshmallow study is not actually testing self-control. In some ways, it's testing who those kids are in terms of what their socioeconomic status is. Are they hungry? Do they like sweets? Do they always have sweets at home and honestly probably could use some broccoli at this point? Do they trust that the researcher is going to give them that treat if they wait for the 10 minutes? So that taps into trust of adults and authority. It taps into personality traits that are more about compliance and obeying than actually being able to work towards their own goal, right? A lot of different things going on there. And I think for me, I would rather have a kid that can clearly see kind of the structure of that. And if they want to eat the marshmallow, that's fine, as long as they understand that that's what's happening. I don't really want to raise somebody who is willing to wait for 10 minutes to get two marshmallows when a stranger tells them to do it if they have a weird feeling about it. I want them to trust their gut on that one. So I have some pictures of brains in here that just shows you in terms of valuation. We tend to have valuation happen in this area way kind of deep down in the ventral striatum. And then we use areas up in our frontal cortex, our prefrontal cortex, to basically rationalize this. So short-sightedly, we say, is this a good thing or not? Is this immediate reward value? So these areas are a little bit lower down in the prefrontal cortex. And then there's a different area, so dorsal lateral, so that's going to be kind of up and over to the side more. This is more long-sighted, goal-directing behavior. And so we have this weighing, balancing thing happening all the time about what we value. So if your child is valuing different things than you are, this comes up as a motivation issue. Okay, so these are some things here that you can do to help with motivation issues. So when you require practicing ownership, this is another thing where you're doing everything for them, they're not going to be motivated to step in and take their own decisions over and control of their own life. You're too involved. Encouraging their own goal-directed behaviors are a really good way to get them thinking more forward-thinking and not as short-sighted. So there's been lots of studies that show that when you have goals, your performance increases. And so that's something parents should be aware of. And then the idea of rewards. If you're going to reward your kid, if you're going to bribe them, this actually can work really well, but you need to make sure of a couple things. First, that you're fostering these learning habits and not routine habits. Okay. The second thing is that trust matters. So if you say you're going to give your child something, you need to follow through. You need to always give the reward or the punishment that you have said that you're going to do. And then understand that the reward matters. So what you may be rewarding behavior with may not be as important to them as it is to you. And so that will become a really important thing if they're willing to do whatever the skill is. Okay. The key here is allowing power shifts. So you want your children on the left to actually feel in these situations when they have autonomy and they're able to make their own decision, like the one on the right here. You want them to feel powerful. So this power then you have to give to your kids and understand that they are this. They are their own person. And your job is to teach them to use this power in ways that don't hurt others and that allow them to get what they want in a goal-directed way. All right, you are going to have situations where it will come out as a terrible tantrum, and you're going to need to contain that when they're littler. But as they get older, you really want to enable them with these power shifts. So one idea here is this idea of game theory. Okay, so game theory is basically how does one person act in terms of motivation, and how does this actually tap into a rule and a consequence, and this balance between what is socially the right thing to do and what is the goal that you actually have as a person. Okay, so allowing your child to come up with their own rules and their own consequences is one of the best ways I know to do this. And so if you have a child who comes up with their own rules, you agree on them together for, let's say, cell phone use at age 10 or video gaming at age 12. If they come up with their own rules and then they come up ahead of time with the consequences for what will happen if they break their own rules, you as a parent can step completely back. You can observe what they're doing or not doing if they're following the rules. And then you're able to just say, what was the consequence you picked for that? And with that, then they basically are clicking into their own autonomous kind of behavior. You're trying to set up the stage for when they leave home at 18, they can do a version of this independently where you're not there to be able to do it for them. So we are actually shaping future free will with the things that we foster or do not foster in our kids when they're here with us until they're 18 during these really intense periods of synaptic formation and the pruning away of the synapses that are not going to be important to their personality and the way that they approach the world in a bigger picture way. And so the way that we do this is with this scaffold. We can boost the skills that aren't strong by giving them these opportunities to practice things that we know they're going to have trouble with. We can deal with the small things. So we can do little reward-based behaviors like being able to get into the car on time in the mornings. And eventually these things will become habits. And then we can change bad habits. And we can do this by the same scaffolding that I talked about with the actual, like the out. So what happens when you come out of time out? How, what have you done? Can you take ownership for it? How does it affect other people? And then what will you do differently next time? Okay, so making self-regulation really intentional is going to take us understanding neuroscience. It's going to take parents understanding that you need to make space for it at home. It's going to take teachers understanding that this is actually a way that you can teach within the curriculum. And it's going to take us letting go some of our kids and letting them have more choices, and then being able to kind of step in and give them the structure to sort through what happened when things go wrong and how to choose again and choose better. And we need support. And so as parents, we need to be able to talk to people about this, to make groups so that we have resources to support parenting, because a lot of people parent in a vacuum because, you know, our kids have specific problems, and a lot of times we don't want to talk to our friends or our relatives about them because we don't want them to pigeonhole our kids and to know these things about our kids. And so sometimes we parent in silence, and we need the support that skills like this can do for us and for our kids. So I will just end by saying the first way that you do this is by refocusing, telling your kids, hey, these three skills are the most important, the creativity, the empathy, and the self-control, and I'm going to start working on them myself, and we're going to prioritize working on them in our family. And that's the first step, is just the awareness that these things are important and pointing them out in our daily life and just the normal things that we do. So thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. And I'm happy to take questions in the chat if that's something that you guys have that you'd like answered.
Thank you so much. Actually, we have several questions in that came through while you were talking, which was great because a lot of people to write them down as they were thinking of them. So the first one that we got came in that says, how do single household parents overcome the lack of a father figure to help teach self-control?
Well, mostly the book is written from the perspective of one parent. So I'm a single parent, and I don't feel like you need to have a team to teach these skills. I feel like you can just teach them. So the best way to do it is to do it in yourself. And I don't think there's anything particularly special about a male figure to teach self-control, because I think self-control is something that we all need to work on. Certainly, I think there is a element of our society that teaches males that the overt expression of frustration and anger that may look like impulsivity or poor self-control is a more acceptable way to behave. But I don't think that growing up with mother figures exhibiting self-control strategies is in any way a detriment to the kid who's learning them. I think there can be a lot of good there that comes from seeing that self-control isn't just about what a male does, but that females can be angry too, and females can be parenting. And you know what? Sometimes it's hard, and sometimes you put yourself in your own timeout until you can deal effectively with what's happening with your kid. I think that modeling it, no matter who you are, gender aside, is enough.
Another question that came in was, how does a parent overcome the overwhelming media propaganda that calls out riots as protests and glorifies yelling and disrespecting authority figures, i.e. teachers, police, clergy, etc.?
That is hard. And I've been dealing with that as well, with my kids looking at what's happened right now with the riots. And so I think this is where it's really important to talk about empathy. So people don't act like that in a vacuum. These are people that are angry, and they're people that are hurt, and they're people that are frustrated. And so this is a situation where you aren't just teaching somebody to recognize behavior that you don't want them doing. And you're not just teaching them to understand someone else's perspective, but you have to teach your child to listen. So when you're having your child listen, instead of saying, oh, that's wrong, let me tell you why it's wrong, that's when the real growth can happen, right? So yeah, we don't think those things are acceptable as parents, but there are parents that are so frustrated right now that they feel like that is acceptable. Why is that? Why are people in a position where they're so fed up that they're taking their children to the protests where they're seeing these things and they're in danger? These are really important discussions to have. And that's where I would start. And, you know, I would say that one of the things that can be a gateway to talking about what should I do differently in your own self, you can do it with other people too. You can say, hey, this is what we just saw. This is a conflict situation. What other choices did this person have? And why do you think they chose to act that way instead of a different way? And that'll then tap into emotions. It'll tap into self-control. It'll tap into motivations. And if you can do that with somebody else, even once a week, if you put that kind of in front of your kids, why do you think this person acted the way that they acted? Then you can kind of move into, hey, I saw you acted that way. Why did you act that way? What other things could you have done? Or you can do them yourself, because surely maybe it makes more sense to put ourselves in that vulnerable situation. Hey, I just yelled at you. I am sorry. This is why I was so frustrated. I should have done this, right? So just pointing these things out with discussions is what we need to be doing as families.
A great answer. In a similar vein, children continually see confusing things. A child hits a teacher and there's no consequence for that action. A protester throws liquid on police and there's no consequence. A child yells at a teacher and there's no consequence, et cetera. How should a parent deal with this?
About watching other people get away with things. Mm-hmm. I think that I would say the only person that you can control is yourself. And I think that that's a really important thing for parents to understand too, as we're kind of, as parents, always trying to control what our kids do, because what they do impacts us. And so we have a really vested interest in it. So I would say you can certainly talk about what feels fair and what feels unfair, but you also need to talk about accountability. And you can say the person is accountable for what they did. How do you feel about what they did, right? But you are only responsible for what you do. And so if you're in that situation, those choices. Again, you could say, what other choices would they have had, right? This is really important for accountability for their own lives and for not making people feel like they're responsible for other people's choices, because that leads to really unhealthy relationships. It's fine to point out things that are unkind, that are not fair, that are destructive, that are disruptive, that aren't gonna in the long run solve the problem. I think those are important to be aware of and have those discussions too.
Awesome. Another question came in that says, what is mature play and conflict scaffolding? And could you explain it more with some more examples?
Sure. So mature play is going to be play for extended amounts of time. Let's say like at least 30 minutes. And they basically have the absence of anything that directs behavior. So you don't want to have video game directed behavior. You don't even really want to have like a sorry board game. So you allow for imaginative roles here. If you're trying to start it, you might help your kids build like a pillow fort or something, or blanket fort, or you might set them up with some clay and a bunch of toothpicks and a Lego guy, and then just kind of let them go. But what you're trying to have them do is basically practice being adults. They may, when they're playing with other people, if playing in the kitchen, non-mature play might be that they make you sit over in the corner and then they serve you lunch and with a stuffed animal. That might happen. That might take 10 minutes and then they're done. Mature play there might be where you guys have now played this game once a week for a month, and now the shop got named, the kid hired an employee, the employee's baby got sick, so she couldn't come into work, and now she's short-staffed, and she has to figure out how to cook your meal and bring it to you, and she ran out of paper because there's no more receipt. So, like, this is real life coming into play, and this is where you end up having the growth happen, because if you have three kids doing that, and all of a sudden the employee says, hey, I'm sick, I'm not coming in today, then you have a store owner who has to deal with that. That can't happen in 10 minutes. This happens when there's recurring characters like Ugly Bob, who always comes and never pays his bill, or whatever your kid decides to make up. These are the opportunities for them to really grow and to practice in a really safe space, making terrible decisions. They just named a character Ugly Bob, right? Ugly Bob doesn't exist, right? He might be a stuffed animal, but they did that and they get to see how that feels, right? And you want them to do these things in these safe kind of areas where there's going to be conflict. Then what if they call Brenda, their friend, what if they name her Ugly Bob? Different story now. You're going to have conflict. Brenda doesn't like being called Ugly Bob. Or maybe, you know, the new kid comes in and they make her like they let her play, but she has to be the orphan who can't afford anything. Like these things happen when you allow for imaginative play, you're going to get conflict. And when the conflict comes, that's when you have to tell your kids how to scaffold. And we talked about some skills in the empathy session, where it's tools for people who are being bullied, how you can, you know, say that you don't like that. You can tell them how it makes you feel. You can ask for how you want them to act differently. And this idea of how you can make yourself kindly heard, be kind and be clear, and then how you can react on the other side when you're the perpetrator, basically. These are roles that every person needs to feel. I think every person needs to be able to perpetrate something at some point, see how that feels. And every person, I think, should have the experience of being like the underdog or the person who is powerless in a situation. How can they stand up for themselves? So that's why mature play is so important for our kids to have.
Awesome. I'm glad somebody asked that question, because you went into a lot of that example. And yeah, just like we're working through a scenario like that, I hadn't really considered, like, you know, how much possibility there would be if you had something like that. So that's really cool.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to start, especially when your kids have never played that way. Right. They come to you and they're like, well, what do I do? So some of that will be, I'm bored. And then coming like, you know, a fly to honey right over, like after. But eventually, if they keep practicing it, kids get better at mature play. That's what they.
I lost your sound for a minute.
Oh. Sorry, can you hear okay?
Yeah, there it goes.
All right, yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's a little bit choppy, but I think it's coming back.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay. Someone says, seems to me that teaching a child to say no to peers that pressure them to do hurtful pranks, damage property, try bad things and say hurtful things or disrespect others, et cetera. There's not a full question in there.
Well, so something like that, I think, this is one of those things where you build up kids where you feel like they need to be built up with the scaffolding. So you can, I mean, we've done this with one of my daughters where she says yes to a lot of things she probably shouldn't. So can you hear me okay?
Yeah, now I can.
Okay. And so we can put her in situations where we say, hey, I'm a dairy, right? Or we say, you know, hey, whatever, you know, I want you to have some candy in my van, right? These are stupid made up examples. Or, hey, I want to tell my mom that I'm spending at your house, but I'm really going to be, you know, with my boyfriend. And then we just literally make her practice saying no, because it's hard for her to say no. And we know that about her. She wants seem really ridiculous and over the top, but they're making a team with us and with her. And they're letting her practice this in a really safe way, what it feels like to say no. And even though they're silly, I think it still is helpful to do stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And that was the last question that we have in here. It looks like we're good. There were some really good questions there at the end. And this is an awesome presentation. So thank you so much once again. This was amazing. And I'm really, really glad that we were able to get to talk with you about all the little parts that go into parenting with neuroscience throughout this whole series. It's been amazing and really eye-opening. And again, if you haven't gotten a chance to read Erin's book, Second Nature, I really highly recommend it. Again, you can listen to it on Audible as well. You can buy it where books are sold, and we have it at the library as an ebook and as a print book. And we're doing curbside service right now, so you can get that through curbside. So again, Erin, thank you so much for everything. This has been awesome. And yeah, we were really happy to have you today.
Thank you so much for letting me come and talk about my favorite things.
Yeah, definitely no problem there. And also, if you haven't gotten a chance to check it out, Erin has a great YouTube channel that also has a lot of great parenting with neuroscience short segments as well. So there's a lot of content in there. So, all right. Well, thank you all for joining us today, and thank you again.
A big thank you to Dr. Erin Claybaugh for allowing us to record her presentation to share with you this way. You can find more information about upcoming events on jmrl.org.
At the time of this recording, JMRL is currently offering contactless curbside pickup for books at all branches Monday through Saturday, with limited in-person services at some branches. We'll link to further information about hours and procedures in our show notes. Please note that it might take longer than normal for your items to be ready to pick up, so we appreciate your patience while we continue to prioritize the safety and well-being of patrons and staff.
This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org. Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss, or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more content. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.